In Iraq today, bombings and battles, at least a dozen dead in Baghdad, as the fighting from a war the U.S. left a while ago now continues. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the nation is unsettled, uncertain, unable, it seems, to step away from the cycles of violence that visited every city, every neighborhood, in what was to be a war of liberation.
On the streets of Fallujah, the brutal attack was met with celebration. "We are from Fallujah," they chanted. "This is our work."
That's reporter John Berman of ABC News in Iraq in 2004, when four Americans working for the U.S. subcontractor Blackwater were killed in that city of Fallujah. Their bodies hung from a bridge, an image that said unmistakably that the U.S. liberators were no longer welcome, had become the target of the war. Our next guest carries a heavy burden of fear, shame, and uncertainty about his country, Iraq, and the war he believed would end all wars for his people. Abdul Razak al-Sayidi covered the war as a reporter for the New York Times. He's currently a senior researcher with the Physicians for Human Rights, and he joins us from the studios of our partner WGBH in Boston. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Do you remember what you were doing, thinking, 10 years ago this month?
I was waiting for that war. We were so desperate for it because we knew that's the only hope for us to be liberated and to be freed from this brutal dictator regime. I remember the first day when the siren went off. That was on the 20th of March, 2003. My friend called me, and he said, "Congratulations." And we knew no one could do the job. No one could remove Saddam Hussein from his palace. Only the U.S. Army and their allies. We thought that, you know, this is the new future. This is the new era. This is the end of oppression, of dictatorship, of abuse. But unfortunately, the price was too much because we gained our freedom, but we lost our country.
Let's speak of that loss, really, from the transformation that you witnessed from that hopeful March day in 2003, to barely a year later in Fallujah, where as a journalist, as someone who was going to be a part of telling the story of the liberation of your country, you find yourself in a very, very different, much less hopeful place.
Yes. In fact, things getting worse and deteriorated, and we thought we're losing our dream. I lived most of my life in a war zone. Since the Iraq-Iranian war started in 1980, which is I was only 11, and then the first Gulf War in the 90s, and then the American invasion in 2003, then we thought this is the end. This is the end. But unfortunately, it was the start of different oppression, the start of different, you know, brutal area. What I saw in Fallujah in 2004, which is I never seen in my life. And when I come back, I said, what's the point? I don't feel safe. And you don't know it's your enemy. It's people fighting each other. People were killed based on their names. That's it.
Let's talk about that day at the end of March when you really entered into Fallujah as a journalist to cover a story which said so much about all of this violence and the extent to which people had been brought down to a level of savagery.
Yeah. We were driving on a highway before Fallujah, and we didn't know exactly what's happened. We know there's something happened there. And then I decided just go by myself as an Iraqi, and I left all my New York Times IDs with my colleagues, the American colleagues in the base, and I will take an Iraqi driver. And we drove as an Iraqi, not as a journalist at all. And then what I saw, it was so, you know, I think I saw half of the scene. You know, when I arrived, I saw two burned vehicles, and I saw bone and flesh was dangling from electricity wire. And I asked what happened. And I've been told, oh, four Americans were killed, and they were burned. And then I said, you know, where are their bodies? He said, oh, their bodies were dragged to the bridge. So I said, where is the bridge? He said, oh, just, you know, 5 minutes walk, 10 minutes walk. Then I walked with 100 of mobs, mostly children and teenagers and they were so, you know, they were so excited. When I arrived at the bridge, I saw two bodies hanging on the bridge and two on the ground, and their kids were there and kind of, you know, celebrating, and, you know, and the smell, that not just, you know, broke my heart, but that made me so scared, because I just imagine myself, I could be the fifth one. I will be the fifth one. If any one of these, you know I work for New York Times. Just the mention name New York Times, full stop, you work for American. It doesn't matter, you know, army, government, NGOs, or media, you know, then they consider you are a traitor or a spy or whatever.
In the midst of that fear, you're also seeing around you, and you mentioned a moment ago, children playing amidst the bodies and this brutality. What did you see?
That was the most, I think, brutal scene I've ever seen in my life so far. A child, I think he's 10 or 11 years old, he was kicking one of the body, and what it was is there's smoke coming from the flag jacket, and he was shouting, "Pacha, Pacha."
What's that mean?
Pacha, it's a very famous meal in Iraq, which is the head of the sheep. And then I thought, you know, this child, what kind of generation we have? And there's many children, by the way. So he's not the only one.
And he's exactly your age when you witnessed the Iran-Iraq war, when you were 10, 11.
Yeah.
But what this child is seeing is so much worse than you ever experienced.
The dangerous thing is this child was so excited. He was kicking the body. He was shouting. I mean, I think I was a normal child, you know. I was scared of the war. I mean, I was hiding with my mom. But not doing this, it's unbelievable.
And at that moment, did you think to yourself, we've crossed a line here in Iraq, in my country, and we can never go back across that line?
Yeah. Yeah, this kind of violence, this kind of killing. And from that time, 2004, things getting worse and worse and worse. And more violent, more killing, more casualties. And then I was thinking, what's the gain? What's the goal? I don't understand. Where are we going?
When did you decide, when did you tell your editors at the New York Times that you really wanted to do something different?
I told them I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit the job. I don't want to work as a journalist. I don't want to see these things anymore, because if I'm not a journalist, I wouldn't see these things. I would just stay home, do nothing. But he convinced me to stay as a very good negotiation tactic. So I remember he said, this world need people like you, we need reporters like you. And it's still exciting to work as a reporter, but just to see this scene, it's too much.
Well, it breaks your heart. I mean, you had so many hopes. You had spent your life, from the time you were a young boy, imagining Iraq without war, and you were brought to witness something so horrible and shameful.
I thought this war was the last war. That's my hope. So therefore, when I said I was so excited, you know, for this, when I was in Iraq, because we thought this is the last one, and that's it. We will live like a normal people in a normal place, peaceful, you know, bright future. But when I saw that time in Fallujah, I said, oh, my God. Is that the Iraqi children in Fallujah? Is that what we want for them? And kick that body and shouting? Is that this his fault? It's 10, 11 years old. I mean, by the way, he was not the only one.
Sure.
It's like children just like celebrating, you know, just like a fireworks. Just like, you know, it's like a party.
Razak, this whole scene was played back to you in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when you met one of the relatives of the soldiers who was killed, and you had to relive this, but from a very different perspective. What happened?
Yeah, in fact, this is, you know, this might be a strange moment. When I was there, I thought about their families. This is the four
contractors. Yeah.
Because my brother was executed by Saddam regime in 1993, and he was hung. We didn't see because he was, and then they buried his body for 10 years, so we didn't know about it. So it's come in my mind, you know, this scene. Do their family know what's, you know, what's going on to them? I don't know. This has come just to my mind about their families of these people. And then in 2009, when I was a student at Harvard and was also a former Nieman Fellow, a friend of mine, she's also a Nieman Fellow, told me that a mother of one of these four is coming here, and she will talk in one of the events, an informal events, and Nieman, would you come? And then I said, no, no. And then she said, you know, she really wants to see you because she knew that you were there. And then I saw her. She was very kind and she was very soft. And I think she was a very good mother. And she asked me a very difficult question because she needs to know everything. She wants me to describe the scene where every single second. She just wanted to see, you know, to know exactly what happened. But of course, I didn't tell her because I was very elusive. Then I tried to change the subject to, you know, what you can tell to a mom of what's happened to her son?
Didn't she deserve to know?
Yeah, she deserved to know, but not from me. I can't stand it. This is too much for me. I mean, from personal level and emotional level. When I saw her, before even we start, I cried, you know? I just cried, you know, before we talk. It's not her fault. It's not my fault. It's, you know, that's, you know, her son.
And that's really that's the theme here. It's not her fault. It's not your fault. And yet both of you are led into an emotional catastrophe that neither of you can ever really fully recover from, right?
Yeah, and I think I know the war is over, maybe for American administration too, but for this mother, Donna, I don't think so. And for other people.
And for you?
I think, yeah, the same. So it's not over because this is the trauma, you know, will live for, if not forever, it's for a long time. You know, it lives on daily in the pain of loss.
Razak, do you think you'll ever say the last war, this will be the last war again?
This will be forever war. Now we know with what we are in Iraq, it will take a long time. The war is not over for us. The war is not just like you send, you know, troops and fight there. It's the consequences. So the last could be, but it might be forever. So it's a difficult question. This terminology, maybe it's a...
There's no such thing as a last war, I guess, is what you've learned.
No. No. No, it was not the last. Look at my country now. I mean, I hope, you know, we have a, you know, good future. But, you know, the violence is still there. The killing is still there. The terrorists is still there. And the sectarian conflicts, the conflicts between factions, you know, still there. I think that will take a long time. That will last for a long time, unfortunately.
Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi is a former journalist with the New York Times. You can read his last dispatch from his country, a piece in the New York Times magazine called Unwilling Witness. He's a senior researcher now, Middle East and North Africa, with the Physicians for Human Rights. Abdul Razak al-Sayyidi, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.